All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Well, good evening. This is American Vindicta. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. Today is episode 41. Today's date is January 13th, 2022. We are going to continue down the path of exploring and investigating the German Empire, the Nazi Empire. And to really break all this down in a way that makes sense, we're going to go over different aspects and elements of the Nazi Empire. And we started off yesterday with a more or less brief history of the Nazi Empire from beginning to end. And a lot of what we're going to go through, we will continuously go from the beginning and move back to the end of the Nazi Empire, because all these things have dates that correlate together. Now, I do want to tell you that today's material, sometimes this material can be a bit dry, but it is all historical fact. And because of that, I want you to put it into your mind that even though some of this material may be dry every now and then, even though I may not have the crazy antics and all the craziness that some of the other people that have podcasts do, I am wanting to just give you history. I want to give you a historical reason as to why America needs to wake up to what it's doing to itself, so that we never repeat the history of Nazi Germany. Now, some people may or may not agree with me when I say this, but there are portions of American society that does reflect Nazi Germany, and it's mainly within our politics and how we weaponize politics, how we've weaponized law enforcement, how we have attempted to dang near conquer the world. And, America is an empire, whether you like it or not. America became an empire many decades ago, and the people in power, the elite, only want to expand upon that. Well, here's the problem. With absolute power, corruption becomes absolute as well. And this evil does not stop in these men and women in the elite at the behest of our voting. We are not going to root these people out by voting. If anything, we inadvertently seem to elect the ones that they have pre-selected to run in their stead. That's why voting needs to be a very stringent thing in America. You need to do your own investigation of who it is that you're voting for. So, without further ado, we are going to talk about the armed forces of the Third Reich, the Wehrmacht. Now, I'm going to be going back and forth on a document that's from Britannica.com that was an article wrote by Michael Ray of Britannica. It's very well wrote. And then also the Encyclopedia of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And let's begin. The Wehrmacht, a German word for defense power. The armed forces of the Third Reich. The three primary branches of the Wehrmacht were the which is army, Luftwaffe, which was air force, and the Kriegsmarine, which was navy. The creation and the structure of the Wehrmacht began after World War I. The Versailles abolished conscription in Germany. It reduced the size of the German army to 100,000 volunteer troops, sharply limited Germany's surface fleet, it outlawed its submarine fleet, and it forbade the creation of a German air force. When Adolf Hitler rose to power as Chancellor of Germany in 1933, he moved quickly to roll back these restrictions. He began developing German military aviation under the cloak of civilian production. He worked with manufacturers to expand German military capacity. Krupp, for example, masked its tank program under the guise of tractor constructions. After the death of President Paul von Hindenburg in August 2, 1934, the offices of President and Chancellor were merged, and Hitler became Supreme Commander of German Armed Forces. German Minister of War, Werner von Blomberg, an ardent Hitler supporter, changed the oath of service for German troops. Rather than pledging to defend the German Constitution or the Fatherland, they now swore unconditional obedience to Adolf Hitler. On March 16, 1935, Hitler reintroduced conscription, which is the draft, effectively making public his previously clandestine rearmament program. The German army would be increased in size to 550,000 troops, and the Reichswehr, or the Weimar Republic, would be renamed the Wehrmacht. While the term Wehrmacht would be most often used to describe German land forces, it actually applied to the entire regular German army, the entire regular German military. Now, I don't speak German so well, so if I butcher these words, just laugh along with me. But the Überkommando der Wehrmacht, which we abbreviate that as OKW, the Wehrmacht High Command as it is, was designed to exercise command and control of these three branches of the Wehrmacht, the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy, each of which had its own high command. Also technically subordinate to the German High Command, the OKW, was the Waffen-SS, everyone's favorite bad guys, which comprised the political soldiers of the Nazi Party. In addition to serving as Hitler's personal bodyguard, administering the concentration and death camps, and carrying out some of the most horrific atrocities of the Holocaust, men of the Waffen-SS also fought as combat troops alongside the regular army. In practice, the Waffen-SS ultimately answered to SS Chief Heinrich Himmler, and its ranks swelled from several hundred men in 1933 to 39 divisions late in World War II. Although they were derisively dismissed as Himmler's asphalt soldiers by the German High Command, the troops of the Waffen-SS were superbly equipped and tended to have higher morale than regular German army. In early 1944, the Waffen-SS made up less than 5% of the Wehrmacht, but it accounted for nearly one-fourth of Germany's panzer divisions and roughly one-third of the Wehrmacht's panzer grenadier, which was the mechanized divisions. The Wehrmacht in World War II. Operation of the Wehrmacht by the Army was by far the largest branch of the Wehrmacht, obviously, and upon the outbreak of war, the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, and the Kriegsmarine Navy units were theoretically subordinate to Army command at a tactical level. This did not yield a seamless combined arms approach. However, as the German High Command never functioned as a true Joint Chief of Staff, when cross-branch cooperation did occur, it was often the result of local commanders creating an ad hoc task force of limited durations. Now, the clash of commands is something that is very common within the Nazi Germany military. The coordination was also complicated by the heads of the Navy and the Air Force, who had no desire to see their branches diminished in importance. Hitler himself had little interest in sea power, and the naval commander-in-chief, the Grand Admiral Erich Raeder, frequently clashed with the Führer over strategic matters. Other than invasions of Denmark and Norway, which were planned and overseen by Raeder, German naval operations during the war consisted primarily of submarine attacks. Submarines were their U-boats, and these attacks normally happened on Allied shipping. The ships of the German surface fleet from converted frigates to battle cruisers were the Scharnhorst and the Geisenau. Now, the Geisenau was called a pocket battleship. He also had the Graf Spee, and these were largely regulated to commerce raiding and the support of the U-boat campaign. So the German Navy more or less helped with the attacks and the logistics of the U-boats. Just two modern battleships were deployed by Germany during World War II. The Bismarck, which was sunk within days of putting to the sea in May 1941, and the Tirpitz was also confined to a Norwegian water until it was finally sunk by British Lancaster bombers on November 12, 1944. Whereas Hitler had a strained relationship with the Navy Admiral Raeder, who was forced to resign in January 1943, the Luftwaffe chief, Hermann Göring, had been one of Hitler's most ardent supporters since the earliest days of the Nazi Party. For this reason, Göring would hold a place of almost unequaled influence within the Third Reich, and he would wield near total control of German air power. Because Göring openly disliked Raeder, the head of the Navy, the Kriegsmarine would not be allowed to develop a serious naval aviation capability. The Graf Zeppelin, the Reich's only aircraft carrier, never entered service despite being almost completed, and its only significant contribution to the war effort was as a floating timber warehouse. In 1940, Hitler bestowed upon Göring the title of Reichsmarschall, and he named him Marshal of the Empire, further complicating the Wehrmacht chain of command. While the Luftwaffe technically answered to the German high command, Göring now also outranked the high command chief field marshal Wilhelm Keitel. Göring did suffer some diminished prestige as a result of the Luftwaffe's failure to knock Britain out of the war during the Battle of Britain and the Blitz, but his authority remained unchallenged by anyone but Hitler until the end of the war. The Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941, would settle the matter of operational organization within the Wehrmacht, the German high command. The Oberkommando der Heeres, which is the Army High Command, became de facto theater command for the war in the East, while the OKW managed the war in German-occupied Western Europe and North Africa. Field Marshal Walther von Brauchitsch headed the OKH until December 1941, when Hitler forced his resignation and took personal command of the Russian front until the end of the war. Hitler's contribution to the war in the West was to order the construction of an impregnable Atlantic wall that would stretch from the northern Norway to the Pyrenees. Consumed by the Russian campaign, Hitler paid little attention to the progress of this directive. Even after the OBW commander-in-chief of the West, Field Marshal Gerd von Rudenst, complained about the inadequacy of German defense in France. Although Rudenst theoretically had oversight of all German units in the West, he was hampered by the Byzantine and inefficient command structure of the German overall high command. It gets very complicated because there are so many different fronts of war. With the West, the Western Front, with the Eastern Front, you also had the high command that was in Germany still, and you also had battles going on in the seas. You had battles going on in North Africa. So it got very jumbled, and Hitler would randomly appoint people into elevated stages of power, and then that would further complicate the German high command. No one knew who was really in charge or who gave what orders until a war or a specific battle would take place, and then nine times out of ten, the Wehrmacht would which would just mainly be the German High Command, the original OKW High Command, would just take charge. Now, as Keitel had learned years earlier, naval and air units remained within the exclusive purview of their branches. In addition, both Panzergruppe West, which was Commander General Leo Geyer von Schwippenberg, and Army Group B, Commander Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, which was what we come to call the Desert Fox, reported directly to Hitler while remaining technically subordinate to Runitzt. This jumble of commands would significantly hinder the German response to the Allied invasion of Normandy in June 1944. Now, in addition to that, the Panzergruppe West was one of the largest SS, Waffen-SS field units that were out there, just in case I missed that. War crimes and the myth of the clean hands of the German army. By the end of the war, more than 17 million troops had served in the Wehrmacht, and the Allies formally disbanded the organization on August 20, 1946. The army accounted for the overwhelming majority of that total 13 million, followed by the Air Force, which was 3 million, and the Navy, which had 1.5 million sailors. In addition, as many as, 1 million men, some of them were foreign conscripts and also auxiliaries that served in the Waffen-SS. And we're going to get into that in a little bit, and it's going to surprise you just who was allowed to serve in the SS. Because of the Wehrmacht, and because it was a conscript force, and because so many German men of military age had served in it, there was an almost immediate effort to distance the German army from the Holocaust and other crimes of the Nazi regime. The so-called clean army, the clean German army narrative, held that typical German army soldier or airman or sailor was no different than his counterpart in the Allied forces. He fought for his country with honor and patriotism and attained by the scourge of the Nazism. This claim went largely unchallenged by the Western Allies. And as the West German military became a necessary component of the Western defense structure in Cold War era Europe, the SS and the Gestapo were labeled criminal organizations at the Nuremberg trials. The Wehrmacht and the OKW were not. Keitel, Goering, and Raeder were individually tried and found guilty of war crimes, but the judges of the International Military Tribunal ruled that their guilt did not extend to the organizations that they led or to the men who served under them. The rehabilitation of the German army was made complete by no less than a figure than former Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower, who during a trip to West Germany in January 1951 declared, and this is a quote, "I have come to know that there is a real difference between the regular German soldier, an officer, and Hitler and his criminal group. For my part, I do not believe the German soldier as such has lost his honor. The fact that certain individuals committed in war were dishonorable and despicable acts reflects on the individuals concerned and not on the great majority of German soldiers and officers." The post-war German political establishment went a step further by courting favor with the Waffen-SS, which was the Mutual Help Association for former members of the Waffen-SS, a social organization of Waffen-SS veterans. The HIAG, which is the long acronym for this, wielded outsized influence in the decades after the war, and prominent politicians from both the left and the right worked to weave the Waffen-SS into the clean German hand legend. Prominent in this effort were a spokesperson, Kurt Panzermeier, a Waffen-SS tank commander, who had been found guilty of war crimes for his role in the Normandy massacres. The HIAG would achieve some success in its primary goal, winning military pensions for Waffen-SS troopers, and it would retain significant political power into the 1980s. A 1995-99 art exhibit titled, War of Annihilation, Crimes of the Wehrmacht from 1941 to 44, triggered a massive reprisal of the role of the Wehrmacht in World War II. The controversial exhibit toured 33 cities in Germany and Austria and was viewed by more than 800,000 people. The Wehrmacht exhibit was criticized because of the historical inaccuracy of some of the 1,400 photographs that it featured. It also featured protests and riots routinely greeted its arrival, and a neo-Nazi group bombed it during its stop in Saarbrücken. The debate even reached the halls of the Bundestag, where members recounted their interactions with the Wehrmacht or with the experiences as members of it. The scholarly shortcomings of the first exhibition were addressed in a second one, which debuted in 2001. The following year, the clean Wehrmacht myth would be effectively dispelled with the publication of Wolfram Wett's Die Wehrmacht. Now, this translates to The Wehrmacht: History, Myth, Reality in 2006. The author's work detailed that the Wehrmacht offensive on the Eastern Front, which he characterized as nothing less than a campaign of extermination against Bolsheviks, Jews, and Slavs, the upper echelons of the Wehrmacht commands were not dragged unwillingly along with Hitler's racist agenda, but were, in fact, fully complicit with it. By the early 21st century, the myth of the clean Wehrmacht had been shunted from the mainstream of popular consciousness in Germany. All right, we're going to go for a break. My eyes are about to fall out of my head, and we'll see you right back.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
And welcome back. This is American Vindicta, and we are getting into some serious history. Now, we are talking about the German army, the Wehrmacht. And we are about to go over some timelines here that will help to put all this in order. From March 1938 to March 1939, Germany made a series of territorial moves that risked a European war. First, in March 1938, Germany annexed Austria. Hitler then threatened war unless the Sudetenland, a border area of Czechoslovakia containing an ethnic German majority, was surrendered to Germany. The leaders of Britain, France, Italy, and Germany held a conference in Munich, Germany on September 29th and 30th in 1938. They agreed to the German annexation of the Sudetenland in exchange for a pledge of peace from Hitler. On March 15th, 1939, Hitler violated the Munich Agreement and moved against the rest of Czechoslovakia. These events sparked tension within the military's high command. General Ludwig Beck, chief of the general staff, had long protested the prospect of another unwinnable war like World War I. However, his colleagues refused to back him. They were willing to hand over the reins of strategy to the Führer. Beck resigned to no effect. On September 1, 1939, Germany invaded and quickly defeated Poland, beginning World War II. The German occupation of Poland was exceptionally brutal. In a campaign of terror, German police and SS units shot thousands of Polish civilians and required all Polish males to perform forced labor. The Nazis sought to destroy Polish culture by eliminating the Polish political, religious, and intellectual leaderships. These crimes were perpetrated mainly by the SS, although Wehrmacht leaders were in full support of the policies. Many German soldiers also participated in the violence and looting. Some of the Wehrmacht were unhappy with the involvement of their soldiers. They were shocked by the violence and concerned about the lack of order amongst the troops. Generals Blachowicz and Jülichs even complained to their superiors about the violence. However, they were quickly silenced. In the spring of 1940, Germany invaded, defeated, and occupied Denmark, Norway, Belgium, and the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and France. This string of victories, especially the astoundingly quick defeat of France through the Blitzkrieg, greatly increased Hitler's popularity at home and within the military. The military officers who had objected to his plans now found their credibility destroyed, and the potential to organize opposition to the regime reduced. After the victory in Western Europe, Hitler and the Wehrmacht turned their attention to planning an invasion of the Soviet Union. On March 30, 1941, Hitler spoke secretly with 250 of his principal commanders and staff officers on the nature of the upcoming war against the Soviet Union. His speech emphasized that the war in the East would be conducted with extreme brutality, with the aim of destroying the communist threat. Hitler's audience knew he was calling for clear violations of the laws of war, but there were no serious objections. Instead, following Hitler's ideological position, the military issued a series of orders that made it clear they intended to wage a war of annihilation against the communist state. The most notorious of these orders include the Commissar Order and the Barbarossa Jurisdiction Decree. Together, these and other orders established a clear working relationship between the Wehrmacht, the German military, and the SS. In addition, the orders clarified that the soldiers would not be punished for committing acts contrary to the internationally agreed upon rules of war. April 6, 1941, the Axis powers invaded Yugoslavia, dismembering the country and exploiting ethnic tensions. In one region, Serbia, Germany established a military occupation administration that exercised extreme brutality against the population. During the summer of that year, German military and police authorities interned most Jews and Roma gypsies in detention camps. By the fall, a Serbian uprising had inflicted serious casualties upon German military and police personnel. In response, Hitler ordered German authorities to shoot 100 hostages for every German death. German military and police units used this order as a pretext to shoot virtually all male Serbian Jews, approximately 8,000 men, approximately 2,000 actual and perceived communists. Serbian nationalists and democratic politicians of the interwar era, and approximately 1,000 gypsy men. German forces invaded the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941. Their army groups, consisting of more than 3 million German soldiers, attacked the Soviet Union across a broad front from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Black Sea in the south. In accordance with their orders, German forces treated the population of the Soviet Union with extreme brutality. They burned entire villages and shot the rural population of whole districts in retaliation for partisan attacks. They sent millions of Soviet civilians to perform forced labor in Germany and the occupied territories. German planners called for the ruthless exploitation of Soviet resources, especially of agricultural produce. This was one of Germany's major war aims in their Eastern Front. In June 1941 through January 1942, the systematic killing of Soviet POWs began. From the beginning of the Eastern Campaign, Nazi ideology drove German policy toward Soviet prisoners of war. German authorities viewed Soviet POWs as inferiors and as part of the Bolshevik menace. They argued that because the Soviet Union was not a signatory to the 1929 Geneva Convention, its regulations requiring that POWs be given food, shelter, and medical care and forbidding war work or corporal punishment did not apply to them. This policy proved catastrophic for the millions of Soviet soldiers taken prisoner during the war. By war's end, over 3 million Soviet prisoners, about 58%, died in German captivity versus about 3% of British or American prisoners. This death toll was neither an accident nor an automatic result of the war, but rather a deliberate policy by the Nazis. The Army and the SS cooperated in the shooting of hundreds of thousands of Soviet POWs because they were Jews or communist or looked Asiatic. The rest were subjugated to long marches, systematic starvation, no medical care, little or no shelter, and forced labor unto death. Time and again, German forces were called upon to take energetic and ruthless action and use their arms unhesitatingly to wipe out any trace of resistance from Soviet POWs. Summer and fall of 1941, the Wehrmacht, the German army, participated in the Holocaust. Most German generals did not see themselves as Nazis. However, they shared many of the Nazis' goals. In their opinion, there were good military reasons to support Nazi policies. In the eyes of the generals that were there, communism fed a sort of resistance. They also believed the Jews were the driving force behind communism. When the SS offered to secure the rear areas and eliminate the Jewish threat, the army cooperated by providing logistical support to the units and coordinating all of their movements. Army units helped to round up Jews for the shooting squads. They cordoned off the killing sites and sometimes took part in shootings themselves. They established ghettos for those whom the shooters left behind and relied on a Jewish forced labor. When some troops showed signs of unease, the generals issued orders justifying the killings and other harsh measures. And just a quick note, this was actually a very detrimental thing to the German army, because the regular German army, not the SS, were involved with rounding up citizens, which was men, women, children, and elderly, the mentally impaired, mentally handicapped, physically handicapped, and then there was also various, you know, subgroups of people from different religious factions to different races, different ethnicities, that they participated in killing. Many of the German soldiers were what they considered to be honorable and wanted to fight for Germany, for the fatherland. They did not want to kill mercilessly entire populations of people. So not only was this really hampering the morale of the German soldiers, but it was also significantly drawing down the amount of logistics needed for these actions. They were, You know, they were using millions of rounds of ammunition that they could not rapidly put back into the field to fuel the German war machine. And all this proved to be very, very costly for the German army within the years to come. Now, in February 2nd, 1943, the German 6th Army surrendered at Stalingrad. The Battle of Stalingrad, which lasted from October 1942 to February 1943, was a major turning point in the war. After months of fierce fighting and heavy casualties, and contrary to Hitler's direct order, the surviving German forces, which was about 90,000 men, surrendered on February 2, 1943. 2 weeks later, the propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, gave a speech in Berlin calling for the radicalization of mobilization measures and total war. The speech acknowledged the difficulties the country was facing and marked the beginning of increased desperation on the part of the Nazi leadership. Their defeat at Stalingrad forced German troops on the defensive and was the beginning of their long retreat back to Germany. This retreat was marked by widespread destruction as the military implemented a scorched earth policy on Hitler's orders. There was also an increased emphasis on maintaining military discipline, including ruthless arrests of soldiers who expressed doubts about Germany's final victory. July 20th, 1944, Operation Valkyrie. Although generally unconcerned about Nazi crimes, several of the conspirators had even taken part in the killing of Jews. A small group of senior military officers decided that Hitler had to die. They blamed Hitler for losing the war and felt that his continued leadership posed a serious threat to Germany's future. They attempted to assassinate Hitler on July 20, 1944, exploding a small but powerful bomb during a military briefing in his East Prussian headquarters at Rostenburg. Hitler survived and the plot fell apart. He quickly took revenge for this attempt on his life. Several generals were forced to commit suicide or face humiliating prosecution. Others were tried before the infamous People's Court in Berlin and executed. While Hitler remained suspicious of the remaining members of the German officer corps, most continued to fight for him and for Germany until the country's surrender in 1945. All right, we're going to go to a quick break, and we are going to start to talk about the SS. We'll see you right on the other side.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing, and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have, access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer: Ready Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800 627-3809.
And welcome back. This is American Vindicta. So let's talk about the SS. Now, what we've been going over today so far is talking about the German Wehrmacht, which is the German army, the German military. So we're not going to go into a complete deep dive today on the SS. But tomorrow we are, and there, my friends, are some crazy, insane stuff about the SS, to include the Nazi Temple of Doom, led by Heinrich Himmler. Now, believing that Germany would be victorious in war, SS Chief Heinrich Himmler intended to strengthen the position of the SS relative to the established German elites after the war. To this end, Himmler persuaded Adolf Hitler in late 1939 to permit the establishment of an armed SS force known as the Waffen-SS. Although initially restricted to four divisions, the Waffen-SS eventually fielded more than 20 divisions. This created an armed force of about 500,000 men and established a command and operations structure to rival the German army. As military defeat reduced the prestige of the generals, the SS further encroached on the authority of the German armed forces, the Wehrmacht. Already in 1942, the SS took over from the armed forces, coordinating anti-partisan operations in the occupied Soviet Union. After the failure of the attempt on Hitler's life, which was July 20th, 1944, Hitler appointed Himmler commander of the replacement army, which was a position responsible for the training and overseeing military personnel, and gave him command of military matters relating to prisoners of war. And we all know how that wound up with the Holocaust. Now, there are some really intriguing facts about the SS, and I'm going to tease you a little bit with it, and we're going to save a lot of this for the rest tomorrow. But the Waffen-SS recruited significant numbers of non-Germans, both as volunteers and as conscripts. In total, some 500,000 non-Germans and ethnic Germans from outside Germany, mostly from German-occupied Europe, were recruited between 1940 and 1945. The units were ordered to be put under the control of the SS main office beneath Heinrich Himmler. And upon mobilization, the unit's tactical control was given to the high command of the armed forces. Now, the history of the Waffen-SS is truly one of those bizarre things because Hitler didn't want it, but he was easily wooed by Himmler. And before the end of the war, the SS took over every facet of Nazi Germany. The SS were a fringe extremist. I don't even think extremist is a good word. Let's just use openly satanic. A group of people who had all different types of bizarre ways of thinking and spirituality amongst them, to include conducting seances and dismembering people. It gets wild. We're going to get into that tomorrow and shield the children because it's going to be a little explicit. They did some of the most horrific atrocities ever known to man in wartime. Now, they were created as a militarized wing of the Schutzstaffel, which is the SS Protective Squadron, the original force who protected Adolf Hitler during his coming of power. And its origins can be traced back to the selection of a group of 120 men in 1933 by Sepp Dietrich to form the original commando group, the Sonderkommando Berlin, which came... I guess you could say it became the LSSHA, which is the Liebestandarte SS Adolf Hitler. In 1934, the SS developed its own military branch, which is the SSVT. And some of these words I'm not even going to try to pronounce. which together with the LSSAH, these people love their acronyms, evolved into the Waffen-SS. Nominally, under the authority of Heinrich Himmler, the Waffen-SS developed a fully militarized structure of command and operations. It grew from 3 regiments to over 38 regiments during World War II. Serving alongside the army, while never formally being a part of the army. It was Hitler's wish that the Waffen-SS should not be integrated into either the army or the state police, instead remain an independent force which was military trained at the disposal of the Führer. But the SS took over the military. The SS took over the policing operations within Germany and the German territories they occupied. It also took over the political wing with Goebbels. And even to the point of there was no longer allowed any German administration that had spying. So if you were a part of any type of agency, intelligence agency, they were all disbanded and regathered underneath the administration of the SS. The SS had total control by the end of the war of Nazi Germany. And it is truly, probably, along with Adolf Hitler, why Nazi Germany really ended up failing the way it did. They got a little too big for their britches, as we say, down in the South, but what really ended up happening was they stretched themselves out so far across so many land masses and even to other continents that they could not completely take care of logistical lines, internal conflict amongst their military, and also while doing all their crazy, heinous acts against populations of people. And it was truly detrimental to the army, to the Wehrmacht, to have the SS fighting alongside them, because the SS looked down upon the German soldier, and the German soldier even to some point distanced themselves from the SS military. And it's interesting when you look at the recruitment and the conscription, because they say that it's, you know, they were to be German nationals who could prove their Aryan ancestry back to 1800. They were unmarried and did not have a criminal record. Recruits had to be of the ages of 17 and 23, at least 1.74 meters tall, which is 5'9". And if you were going to be within the personal guard of Hitler, you had to be at least 5'10". Recruits were required to have perfect teeth and perfect eyesight and provide a full medical certificate. By 1938, the height restrictions were relaxed. Up to 6 dental fillings were permitted, and eyeglasses for astigmatism and mild vision correction were allowed. Once World War II commenced in Europe, the physical requirements were no longer strictly enforced. Following the campaign in the West in 1940, Hitler authorized the enlistment of people perceived to be of related stock. As Himmler put it, to expand the ranks. A number of Danish, Dutch, Norwegian, Swedes, and Finns were volunteered to serve in the Waffen-SS under the command of German officers. Non-Germanic units were not considered to be part of the SS directly, which still maintained its strict racial criteria. Instead, they were considered to be foreign nationals serving under the command of the SS. Not all members of the SS or the RHSA stressed the nationalistic tenets of the Nazi state with respect to the war and occupation, but instead looked to pan-Germanic ideas that included disempowering the political elites while at the same time integrating Germanic elements from other nations into the Reich on the basis of racial equality. I'm not even kidding. The Nazis were all about that racial equality. Here's a quote from a SS colonel, Franz Riedwig. "We must be clear about the fact that Germanic politics can only be resolved under the SS, not by the state. not by the bulk of the party. We cannot build Europe as a police state under the protection of bayonets, but must shape the life of Europe according to greater viewpoints of the Germanic people. Unreal the way these people would think. The recruitment began in April 1940 with the creation of two segments, Nordland, which was the SS Division Nordland, and the Westland, which was the later called the Viking SS Division. As they grew in numbers, the volunteers were grouped into legions, or battalions and brigades. Their members included the so-called Germanic non-Germans, as well as ethnic German officers originating from the occupied territories. And against the Führer's wishes, who forbade using military units of so-called racially inferior persons, the SS added foreign recruits and used them to flexibly overcome manpower shortages. Some of these foreign Waffen SS units were employed for security purposes, among other things. After Germany invaded the Soviet Union, during Operation Barbarossa, recruits from France, Spain, Belgium, the territory of Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and the Balkans were signed on. By 1942, Waffen SS recruitment in Southeast Europe turned in compulsory conscription for all German military age minorities. Excuse me. From 1942 onwards, further units of non-Germanic recruits were formed. Legions were formed from men from Estonia, Latvia, as well as men from Bosnia, Herzegovina, Croatia, Georgia, Ukraine, Russia, and the Cossacks. However, by 1943, the Waffen SS could no longer claim overall to be an elite fighting force, and the recruitment and conscription based on numerical overqualitative expansion. And that's what took place, with many of their foreign units being good for only the rear guard. Now, real quick before we run out of time, I'm going to give you all the countries that participated in sending people into the Waffen SS. Foreign Waffen SS units that were recruited by Nazi Germany are Albania, Belgium, Bulgaria, Bohemia and Moravia, Croatia, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, France, Hungary, India, Italy, Latvia, the Netherlands, Norway, Romania, Serbia, Spain, Soviet Union, Sweden, Switzerland, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom. Bosniak volunteers of the 13th Waffen Mountain Division of the SS Hanscher, which was of 1st Croatia, they have a really great picture being inspected by the Hajj Aman al-Husseini alongside the SS Brigadier Carl Gustav Sabreswig, and that was in 1943. So this group of Aryan perfect people only quickly broke down that ideology when it came to losing the war. They recruited as many people as possible, and a lot of the people who recruited to the SS were going there because it was a job. It gave you 3 hot meals a day. It gave you clothes. It gave you a place to sleep comfortably. And it was what desperate people during desperate times will do. During desperate times, people will do anything to keep themselves alive and not succumb to their morals. Now, if you look at the way the SS ran everything, they were definitely a death cult. There was nothing Christian about any of these men or about Nazi Germany at all at that point. And we still had politicians within the West, within the United States, who wanted to give these men an excuse to hide from their war crimes. That was our own politicians. That was the Allied forces who did that. Now, at the Nuremberg trials, I think if they had the opportunity, they would have just killed every one of them. We all know that our friends from Israel more than went after people around the world who were of the Nazi elites. And we'll talk about that eventually. But for right now, friends, that is today's conclusion of the German Wehrmacht and the introduction into the SS. Tomorrow, we are going to talk fully about the SS. We're going to talk about some of the crazy things they did, some of the crazy weapons they were able to manufacture, and about the Nazi Temple of Doom, which I think you're all going to really like that. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Doug Thornton. This is American Vindicta. Thank you for listening. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.